Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 250, Denver, Colorado. And for the record, the time is 1:35 p.m. The date is May 24th, 2007. The members of the Title Setting Board today are the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State here on behalf of Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. To my right is Jason Dunn, Deputy Attorney General, who is the representative of Attorney General John Southers. And to my left is Sharon Eubanks, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. We have one issue on the agenda today, a motion for rehearing with respect to 2007-2008 number 21 concerning Amendment 41 modifications, lobbyist tax. For anybody who wishes to testify, there are sign-up sheets on the table by the back, and please do sign up if you wish to testify. And when you do testify, identify who you represent. So I'm just going to go ahead and turn to the sign-up sheet that I have right now. I want to hear first from the proponents of the motion. It looks like Jack Tanner, on behalf of the motion for rehearing, I believe, if you'll come forward, identify yourself. And I might note, I should probably just note for the record, Mr. Tanner, that we did receive an email from you about 12:34 p.m., raising an issue that I'll just let you make a record about if you'd like to do that as part of your remarks.
Thank you. I am Jack Tanner. I'm here. I'm with Fairfield and Woods. I'm here on behalf of Andrea Huff. We have filed a motion to reconsider the title setting for Initiative 21. The matter which you just referred is something that I apologize for the timing on, because it's just something in the hurry of things that just sort of dawned on us right around lunchtime today, which is one of the aspects of Initiative 21 is the applicability section, Section 11, which provides one thing in the event that Amendment 41 itself is held unconstitutional in litigation, and a different thing if it's not. Mr. Dunn is, that case is pending before Judge Hobbs in the Developmental Pathways case in Courtroom 1 in the Denver District Court. Mr. Dunn is counsel of record for the defendant in that case, and I just pointed out that it could be perceived as a conflict of interest for him to be an advocate in the Developmental Pathways case and yet appear as a quasi-judicial officer here in this matter. I confess, since we only thought about it an hour and a half ago, I don't have an answer to that question, but I wanted to raise it in case it mattered to any of you. Turning to the substance of...
Let's go ahead and pause there, and I think, Mr. Dunn, if you want to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. I got the email as well, actually just walking over here. So, but I had actually already thought about the issue, and I guess two parts to it. One is I'm not sure, I tried to sort of conceptualize what the conflict would be, and I'm not sure I came to a resolution of that, so maybe you can help me with that, because I do want to try and work that through. Second, I can say is that I do not have a conflict. I don't feel like I have a conflict. I would say even at this moment, I don't know which way I'm going to vote on this. For the record, I am counsel of record with another attorney in our office on the Amendment 41 litigation, having worked on some of the briefing and letting my co-counsel do most of the trial work. That issue, I guess, goes to the constitutionality of the measure itself, generally speaking, whereas obviously title board is a much narrower issue about whether a proposed initiative contains multiple subjects and then whether we can properly set a title. So I don't feel that I cannot be unbiased in this matter. And I guess maybe to circle back around, maybe you can help me understand what the potential conflict is, because I'm not sure where that even arises.
Well, the potential conflict, and I do agree at this point it's only a potential conflict, but the potential conflict derives from Section 11 which provides that the voter approval of amendments of this article shall be deemed to constitute reenactment of some of the articles of Amendment 41 in the event state or federal court declares all or part of such sections to be unconstitutional or enjoins or further suspends their effect. And that's obviously the issue pending before Judge Hobbs. And so that, to me, is a bit peculiar applicability language, because what it means is that this Initiative 21 will have one set of characteristics if, quite frankly, you prevail in that other case, and it will have a different set of characteristics if you don't prevail in that other case. And that, to me at least, was enough to say there's a potential here that there could be a sufficient interaction between the cases that your role as advocate in one and quasi-judicial officer here might be a conflict. And it might not be. I don't have a concrete right. example of how that might arise. As I said, this only was – actually, I can tell you it wasn't even my thought. It was Associate of my office, Susan Fisher, brought this up about an hour and a half ago and said, what about this? And I just thought it was big enough that we should bring it to your attention. You obviously have a lot more familiarity and experience in this area of the law. I'm not surprised that you've thought about it before, and I'm not surprised that we just thought about it now.
Okay. I think if we were here having to decide on the constitutionality of the measure or make a judgment or determination about an legal interpretation about what the measure means beyond our function of being able to interpret the measure for purposes of setting a title board, if we had something that in a way I would be forced to apply some legal reasoning here and that the prior case might affect my judgment, or I'd be boxed in because I'd have to take a position here that I've taken in litigation or something like that, I could see that. But because I think of the narrow scope here, it's not an issue and I don't feel like I have a bias. So.
And I appreciate raising the issue. I think it is something we have to be sensitive to, and these kinds of issues we approach actually from time to time, I think in part because it's a relatively small world of election law attorneys, it seems like from time to time members of the board or attorneys that appear before the board end up disclosing prior engagements or whatever, that it, at least for the sake of disclosing them, even if they don't represent actual conflicts, it's important to note them. And as I recall, Mr. Dunn, at the last meeting, you actually disclosed a prior professional relationship with Mr. Gessler, who opposed this particular measure and so forth, which is fairly common where we've had those relationships. I think sometimes we have had Ms. Eubanks or Mr. Gruskin, I think, disclose the fact that Mr. Gruskin has represented the General Assembly, and Ms. Eubanks works for the General Assembly, and they've been on the same side of cases. And likewise, Mr. Gruskin, I think, has sued the Secretary of State, and sometimes we're on the opposite side. And it's important for us to keep sensitive to those, either the potential or the actual or the appearance of a conflict. So appreciate that. So
the only other thing I would add is that I think if the conflict were apply, I suppose it would have to apply to the entire office. I mean, I'm litigating that case on behalf of the Attorney General, and I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General. So unless there's some allegation of personal bias, I think it would preclude the entire office, which obviously is.
There's no allegation of personal bias for the record, and I think you're right.
Okay.
If there's a conflict, I think it precludes the entire office.
Okay.
Well, let's turn then to the substance of the motion for rehearing, Mr. Tanner. We've had the benefit of receiving the motion yesterday, but perhaps you'd like to walk us through it or summarize it or however you'd like to proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask today that the board reconsider its prior determination and strike the title and return this initiative to its proponents. We believe the board lacks jurisdiction to set a title for this initiative because it contains multiple unrelated subjects. In fact, the only thing properly before the board for this year in an odd year would be a tax increase. The bill title we think is unclear because the bill itself is unclear, and to the extent the bill is unclear, it's not reflected. To the extent the bill is clear, it's not reflected in the title. The legal standard I'm sure you're familiar with, just as an easy example, is the Initiative 55 from last year regarding government services to illegal aliens. The court held that it identified two different purposes in that initiative, grouped under the broad theme of restructuring non-emergency government services. One was decreasing taxpayer expenditures that benefit the welfare community members, and that benefit the welfare members in the targeted group, and second, denying access of other administrative services that are unrelated to the delivery of individual welfare benefits. Similarly, that case is cited in our brief, obviously, as is the Waterworks 2 case from 1995, which I think is actually a little closer to what we have today. In the Waterworks 2 case, the initiative had two parts. Essentially, one was adopting a new substantive law called the Public Trust Doctrine, having to do with water, and the second had to do with the way water conservancy districts worked. It required elections to change their boundaries or to change their directors. The Supreme Court held that unconstitutional as two unrelated subjects, saying that the substantive law of the public trust had little to do with how the water conservancy districts operated, which would be the changing of the boundaries or changing of the changing of the directors. And the court went on to say, to get them under one topic, you'd have to have an incredibly broad topic like water. Well, that water was a fair topic, but that was too broad to put the electors on notice of what was going on. So with that legal standard in place, we turn ourselves to Initiative 21. Section 2 provides this nexus between a gift covered by the gift ban of Amendment 41, now Article 29, and improper financial gain, some kind of improper motive. That is, of course, that lack of nexus is the subject of the litigation in front of Judge Hobbs. And Section 2 provides that. It says that the gift is only covered by the gift ban if there's some improper financial gain involved. That is a substantive law change regarding the law of ethics. Then we go on to Section 3, which sets out new parameters for the makeup of the Ethics Commission. It talks about the political party affiliations of the members of the Ethics Committee, and it talks about when they serve and when they don't serve and when they go on and when they go off. And I can just stop there and say, that looks a lot like the Waterworks 2 case, because you've got one change in the substantive law, and you've got one change talking about the mechanics of how the law is applied to the Ethics Commission. Just like in Waterworks, there was a change to the water conservancy districts, which the Supreme Court said that was two topics. But it goes on from there. Section 3 also changes committee procedure regarding how the committee can issue a subpoena. Section 3 changes or provides actually a mechanism for appeal from an adverse Ethics Commission decision, something that's not in Amendment 41 or Article 29 or Senate Bill 210 for that matter. Section 3 also provides a procedure for getting letter rulings and advisory opinions. Now, none of those, that's one up to five topics now, and none of those topics are sufficiently related to each other to satisfy either the Waterworks 2 test or the Initiative 55 test from last year. They are not a single subject, because any one of those items could be changed without affecting the others. But then Initiative 21 goes on to Section 4, which is provides what it calls an occupational tax on lobbyists. Now, the first thing I noticed is that that tax is not really a tax, it's a fee. It looks just like the lobbyist registration fee that's already in place. The reason the proponents have labeled it a tax is because this is not election year. It's an odd year election, I should say. And maybe it's an odd election year. As a result, under the Constitution, the only measures to go on the ballot are supposed to be tax measures. So the proponents have labeled this fee a tax so they can get it on the ballot. But that carries with it certain baggage. If it's a tax, it's covered by Tabor. If it were a fee, it wouldn't be covered by Tabor. Because it's called a tax, it's covered by Tabor, which means any increase in it would have to go back to the voters under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. But this is the other thing Section 4 does. It says the legislator can change this tax without going back to the people for a popular vote, which means one of the other impacts of Initiative 21 is to amend Tabor. That's not mentioned in the title. It's not really mentioned in the body, except you have to think about it and realize what it means if you've got a tax that can be changed by the legislature. And that's, so I would submit that's yet another topic. So now we're up to six or seven topics covered by the same bill. I think the text Initiative 21 is misleading and confusing and inaccurate for the reasons said in our brief. I'm not going to go through all of them. They're the same reasons that were set out in the memo put out by the Office of Legislative Legal Services before. The initiative also contains several items that are not mentioned in the title at all, and specifically here I would say Tabor. I think if you're going to amend Tabor, it needs to say that in the title, and it should have the word Tabor, or at least have reference to Article 10, Section 20 in those big capital letters to get voters' attention. If you look at the title to this one, it says it's amending Article 29 in the big capital letters to get voters' attention, but it doesn't mention Tabor either by name or by title and section. So for all those reasons, we ask that the board reconsider its prior determination, strike the title as given, and return the proposed initiative to its proponents. Can I answer any questions?
And Mr. Tanner, I think, as I recall, you were also raising questions about the sufficiency of the title as well. And I'm okay. You were raising questions about the title as well, I think. And my inclination is to address the first part of that, which I think is central, whether or not the title board properly found that the measure complied with the single subject amendment. And so I guess I'd like to proceed on that, because if depending on the outcome of that issue, that would govern whether we get to the titles or not. Is that correct? You still want the opportunity to argue the titles that were set if the board were to maintain its position?
I have said all I need to say on that between what I've already said in the paper, so I'm not going to ask for a second bite at the apple if you decide to go forward. Unless you have specific questions about arguments I've made, I'll just be repeating myself, and there's no point in that.
Are there questions for Mr. Tanner? Ms. Eubanks.
In terms of your second argument on the fee versus tax, can you explain to me, is that a jurisdictional issue that you're making, or is this more in terms of how the charge is described in the title itself?
It's just to put context. I understand the board's ability does not include going in or anticipating if it's passed, will it be proper, will it be improper. I would not stand before you solely on the issue of saying, well, they call it a tax, but it's really a fee, and it's an odd year, and so they can't put it on the ballot. That's not my argument. I'm just trying to put context in for why this is, in fact, a separate subject from the other topics I talked about in Section 2 and Section 3.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Tanner? Mr. Dunn?
I tried to unravel this thing and to see, because I was wrestling with the issue of multiple subjects. Let me start with a hypothetical. If you had a measure, forget Amendment 41 for a moment, as much as we all like to do that.
It would be the best moment of my life.
If you had an initiative that proposed a body of new ethics laws, well, let me simplify it even more. Strike that. If you had a law that set up an ethics commission, an initiative that set up an ethics commission, and to fund that commission, you funded it with a tax. I'm not sure whether that tax in this hypothetical would go into the general fund or something more specific, but what is your response to whether that's multiple subjects or not?
I hesitate only because I think it would depend a lot on the way it was worded and the way it was presented. But as a general matter, I think that, in fact, things like that have happened before, and so you say we're going to create this body and we're going to find a way to pay for it. Those two things, if there's nothing more than that, I think that would not. Those are two related things, I would say, because the test is you can have, you don't have to have a single thing, but everything you have has to be related and has to be sufficiently closely related so the voters can understand what they're voting on. And as I think about that, that may be wrong, because one of the corollaries to the test, or one of the reasons for the test, is what if a voter wants to vote for one part but not for another part? The voter's given that Hobson's choice of either voting against something he's for or for something she's against. And so unless they were really closely related, I think that would run the foul of running single subject, because you could imagine a voter that says, I'd love a new law on this, but I don't want to pay for it that way. It should be paid for a different one. And that conundrum for the voter is what drives this problem. And here you've got, voters that I'm sure would love to amend Tabor. There's lots of people who want to amend Tabor, but now to amend Tabor for this, you've got to vote for a bunch of stuff that you may not want.
Just to continue, I guess under that analysis, you could never fund a measure through the initiative process, which some people argue that's what Initiative 55 says. But assuming for a moment that's a single subject, the next question I had was, okay, then let's say we don't have any ethics laws in Colorado. So you want to set up this scheme to say, I'm going to set up new ethics laws, I'm going to set up a commission to enforce it, and I'm going to set up a mechanism to fund it. Then is that a single subject? In other words, adding in the actual substantive provisions.
No, this is why you and this level and the Supreme Court at the next level gets to make those decisions, because I don't know. I don't know. I think given Waterworks 2 and given Initiative 55, I think it'd be, you could easily see the court saying no. But on the other hand, there have been initiatives over the years that have proposed something new and proposed a way to pay for them that have been approved.
Right.
I just don't know.
Along that point, there was two cases I thought I'll mention that I don't think were in the brief or came up last time. In re Amendment Tabor Number 32, which was a 1995 case, the measure proposed a $60 tax credit against local taxes to be replaced by state revenues. In other words, the state would have to backfill what the local governments were saving. Supreme Court held that that was a single subject. In other words, the requirement that the state replace lost local revenue was dependent upon and closely connected to the $60 tax credit. So they found that a single subject. But then a few years later, in In re 1997-98 numbers 84-85, a 1998 case. Same kind of thing. The proposal was to lower state and local taxes incrementally by $25 each year. So a whole range of local taxes would go down $25 each year for a certain number of years, I think. And then the state was required to backfill those to replace the lost local funds. But the key in that case was that they had to do so within all tax and spending limits. And so the court said that language violated the single subject rule because the net effect was that if the state had the constitutional obligation to backfill the local taxes, but they had to do so within the Tabor limits, to keep from busting the Tabor limits, they would have to cut other programs. And so the net effect of this was to reduce other state programs if necessary to backfill the local taxes. So they said the two subjects there were tax cuts and mandatory cuts in state programs. Justice Corliss wrote a dissent that I think Justice Martinez joined, saying trying to figure out how Tabor or other constitutional provisions interact with a measure and how that will play out down the road was too attenuated, and she said that she didn't think that was violated the single subject, that the Supreme Court's role and the board's role, at least at this point in the game, was not to go that far.
I guess as a matter of fact, I agree with that. I'm not considering the Supreme Court, but I understand that argument of the dissent. But I would say in this case, Initiative 21 goes way beyond that, because it specifically says that the legislature can raise this tax without going back to the people. And so it's not just we've got a budget problem because of Tabor, we're mandating this money go to a certain pot and we don't have other money to replace it, so we've got a problem, which is, as you describe it, the point of the dissent. I haven't read that case, but as you describe it, that's the point of the dissent. But Initiative 21 goes a bit farther than that, because it specifically says the legislature can raise this tax without going back to the people. So it's clearly an outright amendment of Tabor. It's not merely that Tabor will have an effect on it, because you can see that dissent's point, because that's true of all the laws. A lot of times when you change a law, it's going to affect other laws.
Right.
And you can't say, and in fact there are cases that say that, just because an amendment affects more than one law doesn't mean it's not a single subject.
Right. Do you think, and this is a question actually for Ms. Eubanks, because I want to make sure I understand what she discussed last time, but do you think it's a separate subject that in this case the money is not directly funding the Ethics Commission, because there's a constitutional mandate that they fund the Ethics Commission? And I think, to speak for Ms. Eubanks, and maybe she can talk about this a little bit, the argument was really what this tax does is fund programs that will have to be cut because of the constitutional requirement that the Ethics Commission be funded. that there was no direct link between the tax and the Ethics Commission. This was really going into the general fund, which would then fund programs which would otherwise be cut to fund the Ethics Commission.
Well, I think that itself makes it two topics, because
yes,
the funds go one place and the Ethics Commission is a different place.
In other words, there's no requirement per se that this be used to fund the Ethics Commission.
Right. So do I think that alone makes it a separate topic? Well, if Ms. Eubanks thinks that, I think that too.
And that's a question I have for Ms. Eubanks. I want to make sure I understand what she was talking about last time, if she was arguing that's the separate subject, or whether the tax, because it really works that way, is a separate subject from the substantive provisions of the measure. And maybe she can talk about that a little bit, to put you on the spot.
Well, if I can recollect my argument correctly from last time, I think the point I was trying to make was relying on some of the guidance that we've gotten from the Supreme Court, especially in the Waters 2 case. And basically the court said that even if provisions share a common characteristic, they don't necessarily satisfy single subject when they don't have a unifying or common objective. And so utilizing that test in terms of single subject, what I was trying to go through is sort of the features of the tax imposed on lobbyists under the measure. And the tax is imposed on registered lobbyists who are subject to the gift ban in Article 29. Is that a unifying connection to the fact of implementation of Article 29 and any of the additional provisions that this measure would add to Article 29? And that the fact that you got the maximum tax rate of the lobbyist tax is tied to, it can't generate revenues that exceed 90% of the costs of the Independent Ethics Commission that's created in Article 29. So, I mean, there's some features of the tax that are seem to be trying to tie into having a common characteristic with Article 29 itself. But I would argue that I'm not sure that even those two features make it have a common characteristic, the tax have a common characteristic with the implementation of Article 29. And the fact that the tax does not have to be spent, the proceeds do not have to be spent on the costs of the Independent Ethics Commission, the fact that then you've lost any tenuous connection at all, to me, I find two distinct and separate purposes. I don't know that it's so much that, yes, the monies are going to the general fund. They could be used for the Ethics Commission. It could be used for providing health benefits. It could be used for costs associated with prisons. I mean, because it's going into the general fund, it can be used for general government operations. Whether or not it's replacing or preventing other programs from being cut that would otherwise be cut in order to fund the commission, unless we're going through sort of like the early 90s scenario, I'm not sure that that would ever be the case, because revenues of the state generally are increasing incrementally. So in terms of the $130,000 or whatever for the commission costs, and assuming that those will increase over time, I'm not sure that it's the fact that those monies could be used to offset the impact of funding the commission, but the fact that, you know, the commission could be funded along with other programs and services. It just fits into the whole mix of providing for general government services. So I'm because I don't believe there is a common characteristic, there's not a unifying objective between the tax and the implementation of Article 29, it's my position, and I think continues to be my position, that this measure contains two distinct and separate subjects that aren't related or necessarily connected. So that's where I think,
okay,
was 2 weeks ago, and I think that's probably where I still am right now.
And so, not to make you the witness, that analysis then doesn't change if a measure sets up if there's a direct link. I'm trying to figure out if it's the fact that it's going into the general fund versus a ethics commission tax fund.
I think at this point, in terms of this particular measure, because at least it does not have that distinct link, you know, the fact that it's imposing a tax on lobbyists who just happen to be subject to some of the provisions of Article 29, and the fact that the amount of the tax rate is tied somehow to the costs of the commission, the fact that you don't have something more in terms of a connection, I don't think those two things alone would does it in my mind, whether or not by saying that the proceeds from the tax are then earmarked or required to be used for the commission, that might be enough to sort of cross the boundaries. I mean, if I have two subjects here in front of me and here's the gap, that may bridge the gap in my mind to have a sufficient connection between the two. But the fact that you happen to be levying a tax on a group that also is somehow impacted by Article 29 and have a relationship in terms of the amount of the tax rate tied to the cost of the commission, to me, that alone is not enough. If a measure came before me that had that other provision in terms of requiring the proceeds to be spent on the commission, then I might be satisfied. I don't know. I don't have that measure in front of me. But right now, I don't have enough of a connection between the tax and the implementation of Article 29 to find one single subject in this measure.
Because my concern is that under that analysis, if you had a very simple measure which said, we're setting up an ethics commission and we're going to fund it through a tax on lobbyists that goes into the general fund, isn't that two subjects under that analysis?
It may be if the monies are required to be spent or an amount equal to the proceeds to be spent on the commission, so there's more of a connection between that you're imposing the tax to fund the commission or you're putting it into a separate cash fund. There's a variety of ways. That may be sufficient to make that necessary connection, at least in my mind. Right now, because you don't have that kind of connection, what I've got in front of me in terms of those two components and a very tenuous connection to the implementation of Article 29, I see two separate and distinct subjects.
Further questions for Mr. Tanner? Maybe this is repetitious, but I guess I'd just like to hear a little bit more about the connection between the tax and the purposes of the measure, because from a slightly different perspective, I mean, one line of cases frequently says that a measure violates a single subject requirement when it has at least two distinct and separate purposes, and the burden kind of shifts there. Are there two distinct and separate purposes here? Now, the measure itself says that the purpose I think is to offset general fund expenditures, basically, and it goes further, and by tying it to the cost of the Ethics Commission, it seems like on its face it's hard to say there's two separate and distinct purposes. Even if the purpose is to get it on the ballot this November, that furthers the purposes of the measure. So could you help me out a little better?
Yeah, I guess where I would start with it, I was just looking back at this, I was listening to this discussion, and the first substantive section of Initiative 21 talks about that the gift ban only applies if it's a breach of the public trust for private gain. And say, well, what does that have to do with any of the things we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes? So, to me, if you look at all the things it does, you've got to say they have different purposes or they have unintended purposes, but different results. And either way, it would present a problem. The purpose. If the purpose is, for example, to create this excess commission and fund it, that would be about the broadest you could do. Well, what does that have to do with changing Tabor? And what does that have to do with changing, and I think the most important, changing the substantive law under Amendment 41/Article 29, which there is no connection in the current statute between the gift and any kind of improper motive. It just bans the gifts, period. And yet this says, oh, no, it's only a problem with the gift if it is a breach of the public trust for private gain. And that's new language added the new section 3.5. And that applies, I would point out, it talks about the prohibitions in subsections 1 and 2, which is not just the lobbyist gift ban, but it's also the $50 per person non-lobbyist gift cap is now also covered by this. And that has certainly nothing to do with taxing lobbyists. So there's, I think there are many purposes of this act. I think the only single subject you could put under this is it's sort of to correct some of the problems with Amendment 41. It would be the only proper topic for this to say there's one purpose. It's to correct some mistakes we made last year, and that's not a proper purpose, and that's not a proper topic.
But if Amendment 41, if it was a single subject, wouldn't correcting the problems with Amendment 41 be a single subject?
Well, that's an issue, again, going back to the Amendment 41 litigation. As I understand it, no one raised the issue of whether Amendment 41 was a single subject itself, so that has not been discussed. Mm-hmm. So I would think maybe if Amendment 41, there had been a single subject attack, and it had been upheld by the Supreme Court and said, nope, this is just a single subject, and you came in and said, well, we're going to correct some of the mistakes that we found in it, I think there'd be sort of a law of the case analysis to say that probably is a single subject. But this issue has never been raised before.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gruskin, if you'd like to perhaps represent an opposing point of view, I suspect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark Gruskin for the proponents. If I can, without meaning to do any justice to the motion for rehearing because it's in front of you, or Ms. Eubanks' point, I won't mention that one again until maybe the end of my remarks, I'd like to summarize the various subjects that are alleged to exist in the motion on pages, I believe it's 3, 4, and 5. Number one is the imposition of the occupational tax. Number two is affecting the ability of the electorate to approve future increases, or alternatively, that may be the third purpose. The second purpose, I guess, is really the ability of the General Assembly, the authority given to the General Assembly to change the rate. The third purpose would be the ability to do that without obtaining voter approval. The fourth would be the references to Article 29. The fifth would be implementing the Independent Ethics Commission. And the sixth would be the potential reenactment. So it appears that there are six purposes that have been identified so far. The Supreme Court said in a case that I like to quote when I'm on this side of the aisle, it was in the matter of title, ballot title, and submission clause for 1997-98, number 74, cited at 962 P. Second, 927. I don't know if this is a holding or dicta, but I still like it. Multiple ideas might well be parsed from even the simplest proposal by applying ever more exacting levels of analytic abstraction until an initiative measure has been broken into pieces. Such analysis, however, is neither required by the single subject requirement nor compatible with the right to propose initiatives guaranteed by the Colorado's Constitution. The court goes on to remind the readers of that decision that the right of initiative is to be liberally construed, and the question for that initiative, which dealt with a fee on the one hand and changes to the initiative process on the other, was whether or not they were directly related. The court said that the title board was correct that they were, because one provided mechanisms used to resolve issues raised by the other. I would suggest to you that the issues raised here are directly related. And let me get to the end of the conversation that was had before the board rather than start at the beginning necessarily. The issue the suggestion was made that Section 2 of the measure, actually it's Section 1 of the measure, Section 2 in Article 29, has nothing to do with the tax, nothing whatsoever, because it has a standard of behavior that regulates how Article 29 will be applied. And I think the reference was, to some extent, made as well to Section 3. But let's go to Section for the measure, Section 10 of the article. The initial language in paragraph 1 is as follows. In order to supplement the state's general fund for revenues expended on the Independent Ethics Commission's interpretation and enforcement of this article. The entire point is that this measure has to do with the implementation of the ethics provisions currently in law, because frankly, to date, they haven't been implemented. The point is that the tax funds the commission's work because of the decisions of the General Assembly, not because of the decisions of the voters. I guess the decision or the distinction that Ms. Eubanks has come to is if you were to pay the $25 fee and put a little star on your $5 bills and hand them to the Department of Revenue, that would become sufficiently related, because then you could track those $5 bills. As long as that was the money that was spent on the commission, that would be part of a single subject. If you simply pay it to the general fund with the understanding that that's how it's to be allocated, subject, of course, to the General Assembly's discretion to increase or decrease the tax, that somehow is no longer starring the $5 bills. It all ends up in the same big pot, and it seems to me that that link, plus the fact, as was pointed out, that the maximum amount of the tax revenue can only be up to 90% of the revenue spent on the commission, plus the acknowledgement, as I think Mr. Tanner just made, that professional lobbyists aren't going to be the only people who are regulated by this measure. So the General Assembly obviously has the ability to figure out how much or how little of a burden professional lobbyists are placing on the commission and set the tax at an appropriate level. And that relates back to how the commission interprets and enforces the article, all of which is encapsulated within the commission's implementation of Article 29. Again, the other connector, remember that this measure in the reenactment provisions reenacts Article 5. Article 5, paragraph 1, contains a mandate that says that the General Assembly must provide adequate revenue for administrative staff and the like for the commission. So the nexus that we talked about last time, I believe, is still there. The question is, what does this have to do with? If there were no references to the amount of the commission budget, there were no references to the fact that the commission's undertakings are to interpret and enforce the article, and that the various provisions are related thereto, I would probably grant you that we have somewhat of a problem. But what exists in law and what exists in the initiative, I think, are complementary and therefore relate to one another, such as to make this a single subject.
Mr. Grushin,
if I can interrupt you.
Sure. The language in Section 10 seems to me to be, maybe the other parts are a little closer called, but the language in 10 about purpose seems to be, to me, to be advisory, I guess, for lack of a better word. I was thinking about it this way in these hypotheticals. If you have, back to the simplest example, if you have a measure that sets up an ethics commission and then says, we're going to fund it through a tax, and let's say in that measure it said the purpose of this tax is to fund the ethics commission, but it's going into the general fund, is that different than a measure that is exactly the same but says the purpose of this measure is to offset any reduction in programs that may result because there's required funding for the ethics commission? In other words, I'm not sure the statement of the purpose matters.
I agree with you in that at the end of the day, they both generate the same revenue that's allocated exactly the same way. What is important here is that there is a cap that is tied to the commission's budget. And therefore, you've got directory language at the beginning of Section 10, but you've got mandatory language later on. But even that directory language is like a statement of purpose, like a legislative declaration, which the court often uses to set the parameters for how the measure is going to be applied. And to the extent that it is clear that if the commission were to undertake some other activity that had nothing to do with interpretation and enforcement of Article 29, that would not be funding that would be subject to this equation, if you will. So, yes, it's directory to some extent, but it also is binding in that if the commission has other activities, whatever they are, or undertakes other sorts of expenses that are unrelated to interpretation and enforcement, they cannot be considered as part of this equation. I think that the we've talked a little bit about, well, we got to talk a lot about Amendment 55 decision from last year. The other decision from last year that kind of has escaped notice was number 73, which was the provision that would have provided, in essence, the no pay to play in issue campaigns. And the court found that to constitute to constitute a single subject, even though there were multiple effects on multiple provisions of the Constitution. There was an effect on Article 5 and on Tabor, and it also affected existing provisions locally and elections that had been held. And the court noted that the mere fact that other provisions are affected isn't enough to direct this in the multi-subject area, and rejected the challenge based on that ground. I think that and I adopt by reference the conversation that was had in front of the board a week ago, where we talked at some length about other initiatives like Amendment 33 and Amendment 35 that developed funding schemes and that developed substantive programs as well, some of which were at best tangentially related. It seems to me the development of a lottery stream of revenue that has to do with tourism funding or has to do with open space is at best tangentially related. It certainly isn't paid by the people or solely by the people who are affected. It certainly isn't programmatically affected. But I'd suggest that the board ought to consider single subject in the broader sense, in the sense that you consider it in so many other instances. And the General Assembly has said in Title 40 that you have to apply it as if this were the legislative sphere. In the legislative sphere, a bill has to meet a single subject requirement. And has to meet the same standards as for initiatives. The most recent pronouncement on legislative single subjects, came in a case entitled Colorado General Assembly versus Owens. And in that case, besides challenges to headnotes and footnotes, there was a challenge to the governor taking a substantive bill for which there was an appropriations clause. And I will tell you that appropriations clause was not a binding clause. It was a clause that was a flexible one. It provided $10,000 or so much thereof as may be necessary for purposes of that statute. So it could have been a dollar, it could have been $10,000. And in that case, the court said the governor couldn't veto that because there weren't separate subjects. And they talked about the single subject analysis. And they said that having a substance and a funding provision in the same measure isn't unrelated, and you can't treat them as if they were separate items. In essence, what the court was dealing with was the general fund. If you take some pie slice out of that, we don't know how much that'll be, it's $10,000 or as much thereof as may be necessary, and you use that is part of the subject of the substantive bill. Well, all right. That's on the user side of the equation. Initiative 21 is on the input side, if you will, because what we're talking about is creating a revenue source that will certainly in the first year be no more than X, and it may be greater or lesser, and that will be used as part of the general fund. And to the extent that it clearly is linked to the mission process, in the commission task, it is every bit as related as in the vetoes case, because there you had substance plus money, some amount of money, nobody really knew how much. And here you've got funding plus related substance. And it seems to me that if it was a single subject for legislative purposes, it's got to be a single subject for initiative purposes. I also think if the contention is right that you can find at least six or seven purposes, or you don't have to tie those $5 bills to the expenditures by the commission, that legislatively there will be certain challenges in order to meet the single subject process in the future. So it seems to me that we've had conversations about many of these issues, but I think that the reenactment is simply part of the substance, it's part of the enforcement, if you will, and therefore part of the implementation. The implementation is part of the implementation. The definitional changes are part of the implementation. There is no amendment of TABOR. The provision that establishes that this is voter approval doesn't change TABOR. It simply says that, consistent with TABOR, this is voter approval. The provision giving the General Assembly flexibility to establish the amount of the tax is directly related to the revenue flow created by the occupational tax, which is directly related to the workload of the commission. Seems to me a single subject, but I look forward to questions that are sure to come.
Mr. Dunn?
This is kind of a loaded question, but do you think the Supreme Court applies the legislative single subject rule the same as it applies the title board single subject rule or initiative single subject rule?
Well, since I'm speaking for the record,
you don't have to answer that. You know,
I mean, the Supreme Court has struck pieces of legislation based upon single subject. The last time it did so, I think it was under Governor Romer, and it was there were 44 different subjects in the bill, 44 different things that were funded. And the administration was able to argue that it was about money. And the court said money isn't good enough, but that's what appropriations bills are for.
Thanks.
Further questions for Mr. Gruskin? Ms. Eubanks.
You advanced the argument that in setting the rate of the tax, the General Assembly would take into consideration the burden that registered lobbyists were having on the Independent Ethics Commission, whether complaints being filed against them, asking for letter rulings, advisory opinions, any of those sorts of things. That's
not in the text.
That's not in the text. That's just theoretically.
There's nothing that
I would be advancing that the General Assembly wouldn't be making public policy on rational basis like that, but they could choose for other policy reasons to increase the tax as high as possible under the constraints of this measure, even though lobbyists weren't having a great impact on the costs of the commission. Correct?
Not wanting to in any way step on the legislative toes or the legislative prerogative, I assume that the legislature would, in light of the purpose that's stated here, which is to address the implementation of the commission, would set an appropriate tax rate. I can't predict in the future what some legislator might think is an appropriate consideration for that purpose.
But the consideration of whatever burden the lobbyists were causing in terms of the cost to the commission, the measure doesn't require that consideration.
The measure doesn't preclude it.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd like to hear just a little bit more about one argument that I'm struggling with, and going back to the argument that the measure amends TABOR. And I agree in generally, as a general proposition, that you know, the fact that one measure may have an effect on other constitutional provisions or whatever is not necessarily a separate subject. Here, what's troubling me, I think, is that, as I understand it, the voters might have a continuing, except for the provisions of this proposal that allows the General Assembly to raise or lower the amount of the tax without voter approval. It seems to me voters might continue to have an expectation that they, under TABOR, would have the right to vote on tax increases. And this seems a little, this comes close to being an instance potentially of voter surprise that the single subject rule was intended to prevent.
I understand your point. There are actually two court decisions that I think are very helpful here. Supreme Court said in Bolt versus Arapaho School District number 1 that the 1984 approval of a bond measure, even though it preceded TABOR, was prior voter approval to allow the school district to increase the mill levy in order to pay off the bond. And then as recently as this year in 2007 in Bruce versus Pikes Peak Library District, I think. Mr. Dunn's nodding his head, so he'll know better than I, but there was a decision in a case where a Mr. Bruce from Colorado Springs brought a lawsuit over the Library District's ability to increase its mill levy, and the Court of Appeals cited the Bolt decision and said, in fact, in that case, I believe it was 1987, voter approval, even though it preceded Tabor, was more than adequate to provide prior voter approval. So it seems to me, all of which is a long way of saying, it seems to me that if voter approval occurred before Tabor and there wasn't some legal issue with that, then as to these issues, there wouldn't be a substantive Tabor problem. Now, maybe what you're saying is there needs to be greater clarity about it in the ballot title so that no one can claim surprise, but clearly it's anticipated that you can have a vote. You don't have to have a vote on every tax if you had a prior vote.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who is present who wishes to testify? If not, Mr. Tanner, did you have any remarks in response to Mr. Gruskin's arguments?
Thank you. I just want to make 2 points. One is regarding the attempt Mr. Gruskin made to tie the language in Section 10, wherein it says, well, Section 4 of the bill, Section 10 of initiative, that it says, in order to supplement the state's general fund for revenues expended on the Independent Ethics Commission's interpretation and enforcement, and then it goes on to this lobbyist tax to say that therefore gives this initiative a single subject, which includes changing the substantive law regarding this nexus. I would direct the panel back to that Waterworks 2 case where the proponents said, well, because we're adopting the public trust doctrine, that means part of that is we got to go back to the public a lot, and that's why we have to have these elections to change the boundaries and to elect new directors. The Supreme Court said, no, that's too tenuous a connection. That's sort of forcing two things together that don't really go together. And I would say the same thing is true of that Section 10. To say that you need to fund it, and you're also funding the way the Commission's going to interpret it, therefore we can change the meaning of it, because that goes to the interpretation, is too far a stretch under the Waterworks 2 case. And then on the last point, I would agree, actually, that if there were that the voter approval is allowed under Tabor, and the voters can amend the Constitution to amend Tabor to allow this tax to be increased by the legislature without going back to the voters. I agree with that. I just think that is an amendment to Tabor, separate apart from anything else that's going on with this bill, and that's why it's a single subject problem.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gruskin.
I appreciate Mr. Tanner's bringing some clarity to my points that I maybe didn't lend. And I'm not going to respond to the second point because I think it's before you and you can decide what you're going to decide. As to the first point, though, this issue is actually very reminiscent of, as in Amendment 33, where the proponent said, geez, we really want to create a whole new structure for giving up GOCO money, and so we're going to do that. Well, what's the relationship between slot machines and GOCO money? Well, they didn't really never provide any. The closest they came was, well, some of it goes to tourism, and maybe some people will come to Colorado to play slot machines. But that was never really a nexus at all, and it certainly wasn't a nexus for changing the rest of the GOCO structure. As well, there were issues in terms of the tobacco tax and all the various funding sources, most of which had nothing to do with tobacco. So it puts you in a very interesting position to have to discern whether or not there's a direct link between funding and the substantive measures. Obviously, if this was a lobbyist tax and it had nothing to do with ethics, you might have a different issue before you. You might not. I mean, there hasn't been a case yet that has said that a funding mechanism. What if the proponents had chose a sales tax or an income tax? I guess the suggestion would be that that's not directly related enough. And I guess the other point that I want to make in response to Mr. Tanner was that clearly that standard that you find in Section 2 is going to affect the amount of interpretation and the amount of enforcement, and therefore the cost associated with enforcement that the Commission is going to be engaged in. I mean, if it is a standard that is more readily embraceable than simply relying upon Sections 1 and 6, as I think someone is already entitled to do, that will answer a lot of questions and therefore affect the budget of the Commission. Thanks.
Thank you. Discussion by the Board? Ms. Eubanks?
I think, or at least I hope, that my previous explanation of my view of the single subject issue relating to this measure is pretty clear, and having recognizing Mr. Grusin's arguments, I don't feel that anything that he has said has necessarily persuaded me to come out in favor of the measure containing a single subject. A couple of points. I think primarily, I think you know where I am on the issue. In terms of some of the points that Mr. Grusin has raised, starting with this last point, I think that I agreed at our last meeting, where we set the title for this measure, that I don't think that the source of the tax necessarily is controlling here. I admitted before that I think that you could have a tax on tobacco to fund the Ethics Commission or anything else. All I'm doing is I identify the fact that the tax is imposed on registered lobbyists in terms of, at least in my mind, trying to establish some sort of common characteristic between the amendment, the Article 29 implementation provisions of the measure and the tax that's being imposed by the measure. There doesn't have to be, I don't believe, a direct connection between the source of funding. What's different from this measure than some of those others that Mr. Grusin has raised is, in that instance, they were trying to provide a revenue source for particular purposes. Here, in this measure, it's providing a revenue source for no particular purpose. It's just dumping it into the general fund for government, general governmental purposes. And that's what I find to be problematic, in the sense that it theoretically it's supposed to potentially, but not necessarily, equate to a majority, more than a majority, of the costs of the Commission, if that's what the General Assembly so desires. But it doesn't have anything to do with funding the implementation of Article 29, at least in my mind, and I think that's where I differ with Mr. Grusin's analysis. I do also believe that there's a huge difference between the situation he described in terms of a substantive law bill with an appropriations clause versus this type of provision that's just putting money into the general fund. In that situation, yes, it is a single subject because the appropriation clause is specifically providing funding to accomplish whatever that substantive law bill was doing. And in that particular instance, I believe it was providing up to $10,000 for the per diem cost of members of the General Assembly participating in some sort of higher ed related commission. And so there, the fact that it was, yes, $10,000 or so much that is necessary, that standard language to indicate that it can't exceed $10,000, but they can only spend what they actually need for the expenses. Here, you just have this money going into the general fund that could be used for any purpose, and there's no real connection other than the fact that it can't, the tax cannot generate more than 90%, an amount equal to 90% of the cost of the commission. And so in my mind, it doesn't meet the test to me that there's a connection, that there's some sort of necessary unifying purpose to be accomplished relationship between the tax and the implementation of 29. Now, I will say that I don't agree with Mr. Tanner's analysis of the various subjects contained in the measure. I think I split it into two subjects, one dealing with implementation of 29, the other dealing with the taxation. I believe that the Tabor issues, both in terms of taking it out of any sort of Tabor spending limitations or any statutory limitations, as well as saying that this voter approval of this measure constitutes voter approval of any changes, increases in the tax rate set by the General Assembly in the future. I believe that's all related to the tax. I believe that's all a single subject. And then everything else in terms of sort of regulation of conduct of people that are involved with governmental activities, both lobbyists as well as government officials and employees. So that's the way I view the multiple subjects contained in the measure. So I disagree with Mr. Tanner and the motion for rehearing in that respect, but I do believe that the board should grant the motion for rehearing in terms of making a determination that the measure does not contain a single subject.
Mr. Dunn.
I agree with the vast majority of what you're saying, but the question I'm struggling with is a little bit different. I agree that it kind of, I think in my mind, it's coming down to whether the tax is a separate subject. I think you're right on the analysis on the substantive provisions. And I think you might even be right that there is no connection. Well, I should be careful using that phrase. I think you're right that the measure, in essence, dumps the money into the general fund. And despite the purpose, the statement of purpose, the 90% rule, I don't think those tie it to the Ethics Commission. I agree with your analysis there. The question I'm struggling with is, does it matter if it just dumps it into the general fund? Can you just have a measure, as I sort of started out this discussion, where you just have a substantive provision and you fund it with the tax on somebody that dumps into the general fund, or whether there has to be some link to actually funding that substantive provision? And if not, then is what we're saying that every initiative, and I don't know how directly on point this is for this discussion, but then every initiative that comes before us with a funding mechanism has to somehow, I don't know if it's set up a fund or somehow have that link established, a direct link, rather than just dump things into the general fund. So the question for me is, I guess, ultimately whether or not just having a funding mechanism that dumps into the general fund and has no direct link to the substantive provision violates a single subject provision. That's what I'm struggling with.
At this point, subject to further discussion, tend to agree with Ms. Eubanks that the measure comprises two subjects, and I do so for the reasons that she stated, and I'll try to resist the temptation to try to restate them because I think she said them better than I could. This has been a struggle for me because I've primarily because I've struggled to interpret the case law since the passage of the single subject amendment in 94. And I've struggled to try to identify some general principles that we can draw from the case law to apply in prospective cases such as this. And at the last meeting, I was a vote in favor of the measure complying with single subject. And at that point, I think I was erring on the side of what I understood the original enactment of the single subject amendment to be. And now I'm viewing that the weight of the case law tends to work against the measure today. I'm really struggling because when I look at 1-40-106.5, To me, which was an act or passed by the General Assembly in 94 at the time that it referred the constitutional amendment to the people. So it was a companion measure. It became effective upon the passage of the measure by the voters. But, you know, I walked through that, my walking through that goes back to Mr. Dunn's question to Mr. Gruskin. Do you think that the Supreme Court applies the rules that the General Assembly applies? And that's really critical. The statutory provision first says that the General Assembly borrowed the language for the 94 amendment from what was already in the Constitution with respect to the single subject requirement for bills. The statute also says that it recognized the case law up to that point about what the purposes of the single subject amendment for bills was, to prevent log rolling and voter surprise, and so forth. And the General Assembly by statute said that it was their intent that the single subject for initiatives be liberally construed so as to avert the practices against which they are aimed, and at the same time, and this is important to me, to preserve and protect the right of initiative and referendum. Preserve and protect the right of initiative and referendum, liberally construed. And one final aspect of that is the subsection 3, the final subsection says, it's the intent of the General Assembly that the title board apply judicial decisions construing the single subject amendment for bills and apply the same rules as the General Assembly. And it's hard for me to look at the subsequent case law and see it as entirely consistent with the way the General Assembly has interpreted the single subject requirement for bills. It seems like there are cases that each side here can cite that are persuasive. Mr. Gruskin cited, I think, number 74, that a measure does to the effect, and I hope I have this correct, that a measure, even though by an appropriate level of parsing, multiple ideas may be identified, that doesn't mean that a measure violates the single subject requirement. And yet it seems like there are a number of other cases that have been discussed where, in fact, it seemed like a certain level of analysis identified separate aspects that were considered separate subjects, but it's hard for me to see that they were compared to other cases. And I certainly number 55 is troubling to me, that a number of the tax cut cases, as well as even public rights and water too, actually going back that far, it's hard for me to see, if I were applying the single subject rule for bills to those measures, it's hard for me to see the separate and distinct purposes. But the fact that I'm struggling with gleaning some principles from the case law is probably going to be something I continue to struggle with, but it seems like on balance, what persuades me is that the weight of the case law seems to support what Ms. Eubanks has said, and so I think I have successfully resisted the temptation to try to repeat it. But at this point, that's where I am, I guess. Is there any further discussion? Is there a motion?
I would move that the board grant the motion for rehearing on proposed initiative 21 in respects to finding that the measure does not constitute a single subject.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. I think that concludes action on number 21, and that's our last agenda item. For the record, the time is 2:49 p.m. We do have a meeting on June 6th that maybe we may have to meet both in the morning and the afternoon, but we'll be talking to the other title board members with respect to their schedule. So with that, then, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.